We're going to move on to module two. We're going to be addressing leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes. Welcome Dr. Erba, who's a professor in the Department of Medicine and director of the leukemia program at the Duke Cancer Institute in Durham. As always, we have our disclosure slides. Again, just to create some context, we have some data from MEBA with respect to patients in the network. We have obviously a fairly large population of CML patients. Also, the numbers with respect to myelodysplastic syndromes. Question that, maybe that's perhaps due to the longevity and the prevalence in the CML space. You also see a fair amount of AML and secondary AML. Just looking at novel therapies in community practice, not much in the quizartinib space, but you do see some gilteritinib, and some data with respect to FLT3 testing in those spaces. We also have a new TKI in the CML space and fairly rapid uptake within the community there. With respect to other luspatercept, those are the data. So we're going to start off with a case presentation. From Dr. Patel and Dr. Mulher, and with comments from Dr. Boucher.
The next case is presented by Dr. Patel with follow-up questions from Dr. Mulher and Boucher.
This is a 43-year-old male. He sent to me because of the white count and fatigue and tired. So we ran the BCR-ABL2 and he was positive. We started him with imatinib and he has a major molecular response. And problem is he has a lot of muscle pain. And when he has a lot of muscle pain, he needs a narcotic medication. And he is in a service. So they tested him at the work and they say, well, this is not going to be acceptable. So we stop his pain medication and we change his medication from imatinib to bisinimib. He has a major molecular response. Still having a problem with the pain. He's not on any of the medication. He's not on anti-cholesterol, nothing. And he's a young guy and fit. He's in a service, so he's a physically fit guy and having a lot of pain. So I sent him to Cleveland Clinic for a second opinion, and they want to change him to asartanib.
Right now, if they have higher risk disease, kind of NCCN recommends, I probably tend to do upfront dasatinib as my personal favorite, but obviously there are idiosyncratic features of each TKI and insurance plan and drug interactions and things like that. I probably use dasatinib for the frontline if they're low risk, and I kind of still do imatinib.
Asciminib, compared to the first and second generation TKIs, how do you feel about the safety of that drug compared to the safety of the other drugs? When would you choose it over the others? Have you been using it in second or third line therapy? And do you believe that, based on the data, it perhaps should supplant that as a new standard of care?
So they threw a lot of questions at you quickly, right?
Yeah.
So again, you know, the muscle pain, I think, is important. And have you seen that in patients on TKIs for CML?
I mean, it's listed, but it's quite unusual. It might happen at the beginning of therapy and then get better. The other place you see it is during a treatment-free remission. At the beginning, you get muscle pain and arthralgias. So it's a little unusual. And for a patient like that, I would try taking them off of all TKIs for a period of time, you know, a couple of weeks, to see if it really is related to taking it daily before just assuming it was one of those drugs. It's interesting that it's happened both with imatinib and bosutinib and may have something to do with, blocking other tyrosine kinases, but you know, it's a little unusual.
Right. You always wonder about cytochrome issues. But yeah. So with respect to second generation TKIs in the CML space, what's the role of asciminib, particularly with respect to toxicities? We're going to get into some data, but quick thoughts.
Yeah, I tend to prefer a second generation TKI in the frontline setting. You get patients into a quicker remission, so that's exciting for the patient. You hit those landmarks more easily. Unfortunately, nilotinib was the only one to show a statistically significant decrease in the endpoint that I really care about, and that's progression to advanced phase. I think it's really hard to tease out overall survival. But what we're really dealing with here is how to prevent that patient who presents to you progressing to blast phase very quickly. And it's very difficult to identify those patients even by any of the risk scores that we have. So if they are high risk, I definitely want to use a second generation TKI. Otherwise, I might favor imatinib based on the toxicity profile and the fact that we're treating a lot of older patients with comorbidities.
What about the side effects in the chronic phase CML patients on the asciminib? Tolerable?
On asciminib? Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, and you saw my disclosure, so you know I'm a consultant in Novartis, but I'll tell you, every single patient that I've switched says their life is completely changed. No matter what they were on, they feel better. Now, I'm not talking about hundreds or thousands of patients, but it's reproducible every single time. And I think it's because all of the other TKIs, all the other five that are approved, are targeting the ATP binding site, which is relatively conserved between other kinases, right? I mean, you have to bind ATP to be a kinase. Here, you're with asciminib, you're binding to the myristoyl pocket, which may not be as closely conserved with other enzymes. In fact, I don't know what other enzymes would
right,
even have.
Right, so let's cross over. I think historically in the community, we haven't had a lot of empathy for these patients, right? If you go up in the days of, well, I've got to transplant this patient, right? And right. And you evolve to, here's a TKI. So I think, but it is nice to see in this space, pirtobrutinib, the CLL space, like, you know, therapy with very limited side effects and improved tolerability.
It's not just the limited side effects. It is the efficacy, because I really do believe that one of the reasons why we see progressions in patients is noncompliance. And I think it's completely underestimated. And so a drug that has fewer toxicities may actually lead to better long-term outcomes. It's going to be hard to prove that, but that's my belief.
Well, let's see the outcomes. You got them here.
Well, I look at the ASCEMBL trial. It's a trial that got the drug approved. But there are two major criticisms of this study. It's patients in third line therapy for chronic phase CML. They've had imatinib. They've had a second generation drug. And then they are randomized because they have not maintained a major molecular response or achieved one between asciminib and bosutinib. Okay, so what's the problem here? Well, the problem is the control arm. The control arm is bosutinib, and when you ask many academic CML docs what they would give in third line, it would be ponatinib, even with its toxicities, which we have learned to manage with reduced doses and using aspirin. So that's what we would go to in third line. So the comparator isn't the best, and Novartis was forced to use 500 milligrams daily, which was the FDA-approved dose of the drug. And so, and use bosutinib for the same reason, because the patients hadn't exhausted all other options and didn't have a T315I mutation. And so the control arm is what it is, and it made asciminib look really good. I guess that's me on the next slide.
Hey, quickly, do you think 40 twice a day versus 80 once a day?
Oh, I do 80 once a day.
Okay.
Yeah, and maybe the
back next, to the compliance. Right?
Maybe the greatest thing that Novartis did since nilotinib was go back to a once a day, still with a food restriction, unfortunately. But there it is. Here's the ASCEMBL response rates, and you can see at every time point, 6 months, 96 weeks, 156 weeks, asciminib outperformed bosutinib with a higher rate of major molecular response. But there's something interesting about that study. That study had a crossover to it. And it begs the question, what is really the activity of asciminib, which is basically just targeting ABL in patients who have truly been resistant to a couple of different TKIs, not just intolerant, but to get in that study, they had to be resistant. And there was a crossover. And there were 25 patients who crossed over from bosutinib to asciminib. And all but one had an BCR-ABL over 10%. So these were really resistant patients. And only two achieved a complete cytogenetic remission with a BCR-ABL ratio less than 1%. None of them had a major molecular response. And so I really think what we're seeing there is the tolerability of asciminib more so than any special activity of the drug. That's my guess. And so with that in mind, the ask for a first study of asciminib versus all standards of care TKIs, I think is really quite interesting. The doctor was asked to say upfront, were they going to put the patient on imatinib or a second-generation TKI? And they were randomized one-to-one between asciminib, 240 milligram tablets once a day, or the doctor's choice with the patient of imatinib versus a second-generation drug. And the primary endpoint is response, major molecular response. And what you can see here at 48 weeks, close to a year, that when you compare asciminib to all of the other TKIs, there was a statistically significant increase, greater rate of major molecular response, 68% versus 49%. And if you only look at imatinib, major molecular response was 69% versus 40%. One of the criticisms of the study is that, and I don't think I have the slide here, but you do, when it's compared to the second generation drugs, there's still a numeric benefit of asciminib, but it did not meet statistical significance. Oh, I'm sorry, and here it is. I forgot we included it. So based on this trial, the FDA granted accelerated approval of asciminib for newly diagnosed chronic phase CML patients. And it really begs the question, you know, which patient are you even going to think about giving asciminib to as first-line therapy? And what data would I like to see? What I'd really like to see is the rates of progression. I would like to see the five-year update on, you know, very deep responses that might lead to a treatment-free remission. We are already seeing that we're seeing a new class of mutations now, not in the ATP binding site, but in the myristoyl binding site. And what I'd like to see there is, can you then sequence these drugs and go from asciminib to another ABLE TKI? So there's a lot of data missing. So we're making decisions based on this one trial. And I would say that the most likely way that this decision is going to be made is not by you and not by the patient, but by third-party carriers, because this is going to be an expensive drug. It's FDA approved. But I am guessing that many third-party carriers are going to say you have to, you know, be on another drug before getting asciminib. That's my guess. For my patients, I would strongly consider asciminib because, as I said, keeping them on drug and keeping BCR-ABL, you know, quieted, especially early on, is very important in terms of preventing progression. And in every single study in CML, including way back in the interferon days, most of the progressions occur in the first year, and you don't know how to predict them. So I would like to see them get, my patients get an effective drug, which this clearly is, with the best toxicity profile.
So based on that progression rate, the rapidity with which we get to MRD negative is, you know, our major molecular response is critical still in your mind?
Yes, okay. It is.
Yeah. All right, we've got a few back-to-back cases here. So Dr. Mulhern's first, I believe.
The next case is presented by Dr. Mulhern with a follow-up question from Dr. Lamar, 88-year-old woman.
She presented with worsening anemia, fatigue. When she was first seen by us, her hemoglobin was already 7.5, and she required a couple units over the past 3 weeks. What we found there on the bone marrow biopsy, 20% ring sideroblasts. She had an SF3B1 mutation, and her EPO level was less than 200. So what is the optimal frontline therapy for this patient? And I think that she meets criteria for upfront luspatercept. However, her EPO level is low. You think she would respond to an ESA, especially considering the cost. Which one would you use in this case? What if her EPO level was higher? How does that influence your thinking? Now, she's RS positive. She's ring sideroblast. What if she's RS negative? So we've got an approval. Does the severity of the anemia matter? What happens if she's RS positive, but she's presenting with a hemoglobin of 9.8? And she's never had transfusions. Are you immediately going to go to using luspatercept? Or if her EPO level is lower, would you do an ESA first? Again, especially considering the cost there.
What's the follow-up on her?
So she actually did start on luspatercept because I thought her anemia was more severe. And she's responded, and her last hemoglobin was 9. So she's been transfusion-free for 3 weeks.
I recently learned about a new drug, imetelstat. What is the role of imetelstat, if any, in this case? How do you determine whether to use luspatercept versus imetelstat? And how are the side effect profiles different?
So if you haven't met Dr. Mulheron, he asks lots of questions in a row before you get to the answer. So again, you know, your thoughts on, from our faculty experts, what would your thought be in an older patient, you know, i.e. not a transplant candidate with a lower risk MDS with 20% ring sideroblasts and SF3B1 mutation, significant anemia, and how does the EPO level itself and the presence or absence of ring sideroblasts and SF3B1 mutations impact your decision there?
Well, you know, I think BMS was hoping that the COMMANDS trial would make this a non-question, that it's been answered, and yet still the question exists. And we're going to look at the results of the COMMANDS trial in some of the studies, but it looked at this in previously untreated patients with the anemia due to MDS. Do you start with erythropoietin or do you start with luspatercept? And the answer was you start with luspatercept if you look at just the primary endpoint of the transfusion independence and, very importantly, the duration of transfusion independence. However, if you look at patients in that study, 75% of those patients had ring sideroblasts or SF3B1. Now, I don't think in low-risk MDS it's that high, and I have a feeling there was some kind of selection bias for patients going on the study where the doctor was hoping that their patient would get luspatercept based on the activity there. But for whatever reason, when you look at then the subset analysis, there was virtually no difference in response rates or duration of responses in patients who do not have an SF3B1 and who do not have a ring sideroblast. So I'm dropping down to one of those questions. The second thing to keep in mind is that this patient could very well respond to erythropoietin. And as you'll hear me speak about in AML, I'm more of a believer in sequencing for my older patients and having drugs available to them, especially unlike what you guys are doing in lung cancer, where we don't have so much. So I want to keep options open. My patients like hearing that they have options coming up. And so in a patient with a low EPO level, I get it that luspatercept in this situation, SF3B1, ring sideroblast, the response rate is going to be greater and the duration longer. However, no one has shown me the data that it makes a difference in terms of quality of life or long-term survival, which when you start with in this situation where the patient may also respond to an ESA.
Yeah, I think they're intriguing questions. You know, some of that may be determined by the payer when you start thinking about EPOs with biosimilars relative to imetelstat versus, you know, luspatercept there. I think Dr. Patel, let's see. We got one more.
Did you want me to make a comment about imetelstat?
Yes, please.
Okay. So imetelstat is a telomerase inhibitor. Telomerase activity is overactive in malignant cells, and by inhibiting that, you can preferentially get rid of the malignant clone. That's the potential of imetelstat in the proposed mechanism of action. And so it's been recently approved for patients with anemia based on a placebo-controlled trial in patients who had already been through erythropoietin. Very few of those patients had been through luspatercept, but they were EPO failures. And there was a benefit of imetelstat over placebo. The thing to keep in mind about imetelstat is the dosing. It's IV as opposed to luspatercept and ESAs, which are sub-Q. It's every 4 weeks. One thing to remember about luspatercept when you're dosing it is you start at 1 mg/kg, but don't forget to ramp up the dose up to the maximum 1.75 if you're not seeing a response. And I see that sometimes in my practice. On the other hand, with imetelstat, it's a single dose that you're giving the patient. And my final point about imetelstat is the toxicity. Compared to luspatercept and ESAs, imetelstat can cause and does cause cytopenias. So in an older patient who may just need transfusions, you have to think closely about giving them imetelstat if you're going to make them neutropenic or at risk of infections. But that could be managed.
And a significant percentage in that luspatercept have to dose escalate, right?
Required
dose escalate.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
All right. Dr. Patel is going to present another MDS case for us.
The next case is presented by Dr. Patel.
This is a young guy admitted recently at the hospital with pancytopenia. We did the bone marrow biopsy because I was expecting acute leukemia and end up seeing myelodysplastic syndrome with excess blast. So we just started him on the azacitidine with venetoclax. And the goal is to get him to the tertiary center for possible transplant because of his age.
How's he been doing so far?
So far doing good. In fact, he was here today.
Any questions about HMA venetoclax and high-risk MDS?
More and more center is favoring this combination. In fact, I just had a young guy, maybe 67. So I was thinking he should go and get 7 and 3 because he has a full-blown AML. So when he went there, academic center, they suggest no 7 and 3, go with the azacitidine and venetoclax combination, and then we will search for the stem cell match for you. More and more people are recommending even for the fit patient.
Okay, lots of questions piling up for you here to get to the data, but with respect to, you know, the question that us in the community, you know, with the VIN-AZA data, how much VIN, what's the dose, what's the duration, right?
Yeah.
It's a bit of an unknown. And what's your strategy there? And how does it, not only from a maintenance standpoint, but also, you know, upfront setting for patients?
So the first comment to make is this really high-risk MDS or is it AML? And the International Consensus Conference says if you have between 10 and 20% blast, you can call it either. And it allows patients and doctors to choose the therapy that they think, without much data sometimes, would be best for in that situation, and allow them to go on clinical trials. So you could consider this patient as AML already by International Consensus Conference. The reason that I use for using this combination in higher risk MDS, 10 to 20% blasts, is if I am going to bring the patient to transplant. 80% of these patients in the data that's been presented by Jackie Garcia for the investigators achieved a response. Now, half of those were morphologic leukemia-free states, and a quarter were true CR. So the CR rate was very similar to azacitidine alone. So what it's speaking to is the myelosuppression that you're going to get by adding in the venetoclax. But if you're going to send the patient to transplant, you have a rescue there. And so as long as the patient's going to transplant, you can do that. And your transplanters will take the patient because now they've had cytoreduction. So it's a great way to get the patient to a transplant. The challenge is if they're not going to get a transplant, is there going to be a benefit of AZA-VEN over AZA alone? And as you know, the Verona trial is looking at that question. It's a survival endpoint of AZA placebo versus AZA-VEN, and it'll read out in 2025. My feeling about the combination of AZA-VEN, especially the VEN, is great at getting the blast count down. That's what it does, because it's a BCL-2 inhibitor. And so the blasts go down. It's also great at suppressing the marrow. And that's the problem in MDS. And so if you are going to use AZA-VEN in patients that aren't going to transplant and their counts aren't recovering, keep in mind you could drop the venetoclax and just go back to treating them like they were MDS. You're not committing a sin by dropping the venetoclax. And I've done that in a number of my patients, and you know, okay, I said sin, and now I'll say miraculously, the blood counts get better.
Oh, that's super valuable, because we deal with this in the community all the time, and we're, you know, ingrained, hey, you got to stay on the HMA, or you're going to be right back where you started. But then, to your point with the VIN, like, how do we adopt and adjust and modify that?
So, yeah, and I think the Verona trial may end up being a negative trial like every other phase 3 study in MDS, unfortunately, where we've added something new, pevonedistat, sabatolimab, and now recently magrolimab. All of these were negative trials. And, you know, it can be a negative trial if the study protocol required patients to stay on venetoclax indefinitely. The other thing to keep in mind is when they do progress to AML, they could still get venetoclax. And so is that going to undermine the survival benefit? And so the only way I really think we'll see a survival benefit is if more patients get a transplant, like this patient, after AZA-VEN. But, you know, I was wrong about the magrolimab trial. I thought that was going to be a positive study. So, you know, don't don't buy any stock based on what I say.
Back to the lower risk MDS, folks. You want to go through the mechanism here?
Yeah, just a little bit. It's different than an ESA that is driving those progenitors. What this does, it's a trap protein. It binds up TGF-beta ligands. And based on that, and you can see from this, gee, those mechanisms don't quite overlap. Maybe you should be giving these together. And there's a little bit of data out there, but I'm not convinced that it really shows any added benefit. But quite frankly, sometimes when I have a patient on an ESA already and I'm going to switch them to luspatercept, I might actually keep them on the ESA and give them luspatercept at the same time just to see if I see any response.
In the previous patient, MDS, AML patient, what if they have
Thank you. So I think one of the questions that I saw earlier was, what situations, besides sending a patient to transplant, would I use Aza-Ven? And that's a really great question, and I'm using the molecular profile now. If they have an IDH mutation, IDH1 or IDH2, I'm using Aza-Ven in that situation. The disease is very sensitive. And keep in mind, if there's an NPM1 mutation, that's not even MDS anymore by WHO. That is now AML. 2% blasts, NPM1 mutation, that's AML. And I've actually treated those patients with Aza-Ven if they're unfit. And if they're younger, I'll give those patients, even without increased blasts, 7 and 3, HIDAC, to try to cure them of their disease and avoid the need for a transplant. And I've done that, and a number of my colleagues, when I've told, you know, when I'm doing something that's kind of out there, I often ask my colleagues, what would you do? And I get the same answer, that we're treating that very aggressively. So that's the other situation where I would use it.
We'll have some data coming up, one, the FLT3 inhibitors and others. Just, you know, there's also, you know, a large online presence. So if, for their benefit, like if you guys have questions, you can submit them through the iPad, so they'll be able to see that too. So thank you.
So here's the MEDALIST that trial that led to the approval of luspatercept with a transfusion in improvement in transfusion independence at every time point compared to placebo in these patients who had failed in ESA. You know, the toxicity that came out of this, it's not on the slides, but you'll see it. The toxicity that was published was fatigue. And I really thought, I think I see fatigue in these patients. But I'm going to show you from the commands trial that maybe fatigue isn't actually seen with luspatercept when you have an appropriately controlled trial. So here's the commands trial that we talked about, and I already mentioned this data. Luspatercept outperformed erythropoietin, looking at the primary endpoints of erythroid response and transfusion independence for more than 12 weeks and more than 24 weeks. But as I said, the benefit was really seen in those with an SF3B1 mutation or ring sideroblast. In the patients who didn't have those, there was really no difference. And you could see that although luspatercept outperformed EPO, even when the EPO level was less than 200, there was still 41% of patients who had a response. So I think it is still worth considering either in that situation, no ring sideroblast, no SF3B1. I think you can discuss both with patients, and you'll end up sequencing them anyways.
Yeah, I think if we were looking at like RECIST criteria for solid tumors, those would be pretty salty graphs, right?
Yeah. Whatever those are. I mean, I have no idea what you guys do on a daily basis, you know. Leukemia is hard enough for me. And this is what I was talking about, this asthenia, which came out as a toxicity in the MEDALIST trial, wasn't really seen here when you had EPO in the control group. And these toxicity slides basically show that they're pretty similar across the board, and really nothing came out as different in toxicity. And imetelstat, as I mentioned, is the telomerase inhibitor. I've already gone through this data. The IMerge trial, a 2-to-1 randomization between imetelstat at a fixed dose every 4 weeks IV versus placebo with the primary endpoint of transfusion independence. And again, outperforming placebo in these patients who had failed to have a response to EPO or were not expected to have a response to EPO. And those responses that they did have lasted longer, with a median duration of just about 52 weeks a year. But the toxicity is highlighted on the top there. The hematologic toxicity is what you have to consider when you're thinking about using imetelstat in your patients who may already have cytopenias or who don't have cytopenias and don't want to go from being a patient who just needs an EPO shot or a transfusion every 4 to 8 weeks to being a patient who gets neutropenic infections and ends up in the hospital. Okay.
So a couple of questions from the audience, if you don't mind. You know, the question came up about AZA versus D-cytobine. Do you have a strategic preference if it's a payer mandate, et cetera?
No preference. I in the upfront setting with AZA, I use AZA-VEN. Why? Because that's the trial that showed the survival benefit. Maybe D-cytobine-VEN would do the same thing. But remember, low-dose ARA-C and VEN did not quite hit the survival benefit compared to low-dose ARA-C. So I just use AZA-VEN there. When I'm using in the relapse setting, all bets are off, and I actually use decitabine there to be, maybe that's fair balance. Carlos De Castro at my site, decitabine, never used anything else, right. You know, and he's a really
And on your AZA, are you sub-Q in that?
I do, but I like, because they're often getting transfusions, I do put in a port, and it avoids the subcutaneous right. reactions.
Okay. That's a lot. Okay. Question from the audience. Patient with hemochromatosis, but also MDS, who's perhaps failed ESC and luspatercept. And we get into where does somatostat and the sequencing of these. We don't necessarily know those, but love to have your thoughts here as an expert.
Great question there. So, first of all, I would like to know what is meant by the hemochromatosis, because is it true hereditary hemochromatosis, or is it the much more common situation where you see high ferritin levels, high saturation in patients with sideroblastic anemias because it's an iron loading state?
Let's go with the former, because I have a cadre of those guys that HFE testing positive, you know, documented homozygous C2A2Y, and you're like, oh no.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can't phlebotomize them, and you could try to give them an oral iron chelator, which is what we'll try to do. But keep in mind, in the phase 3 study of the desferoxirax, 50% of patients came off of it because of toxicity. It's not an easy drug to take, and that's either formulation of the desferoxirax.
All right. A few more case presentations, Dr. Mulheron and Dr. Boucher.
The next case, presented by Dr. Mulheron with a follow-up question from Dr. Boucher, is a 74-year-old woman who presented with fatigue and atraumatic bruising and on workup was found to have AML.
Although cytogenetics are normal, she has an IDH1 mutation. So what's the best initial treatment for this patient? So she's not over 75, but she's not fit. What is the activity of using VEN, you know, NHMA, and IDH1 mutated patients?
What's her current status?
She was admitted and started ivosidenib and azacitidine and has responded. She did have mild differentiation syndrome, but you know, very mild. It was weight gain. All these patients are getting daily weights. The nurses have been educated on what to look for, and she has edema and some dyspnea. But she didn't go to the ICU. She needed some dex, you know, some diuresis, and some help from pulmonary. And she actually did relatively well with that.
With the IDH1 and 2 inhibitors, if a patient develops the differentiation syndrome, what do you recommend specifically? Does the patient need to be in the hospital? And what is the likelihood that they're going to have another relapse and develop differentiation syndrome if you've held drug for a while because of it and then go back and start using it again? What is the incidence of second occurrences?
Okay, a couple more questions thrown your way. For optimal initial treatment for the unfit patient with newly diagnosed AML with an IDH1, what do we know about the VEN combination and HMA taking into account IDH1 status, and how does that impact your decision? And then with respect to the differentiation syndrome that Ralph alluded to there.
Okay, so I'm going to show slides some in a bit, so I'm not going to go through all the data now. But what I'll say is venetoclax alone is very active in IDH-mutated disease. And this was shown by Marina Konoplyava in the phase 1 study, where they only had a response rate of 15%, but it was almost all IDH-mutated patients. And there's something about the biology of the mitochondria in those patients that makes them very sensitive to an anti-apoptotic approach. So it's very active, but I'll tell you, I believe in starting patients with an IDH1 mutation on ivosidenib and azacitidine based on the results of the AGILE trial. But I'll go through the data to show you what about the data really makes me feel that's the right thing to do. For an IDH2 mutation, completely different. And these mutations, although they start with IDH, right? They do the same thing, isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, you get the mutation, you get the 2-hydroxyglutarate. They're doing the same thing, but they have very different prognostic impacts and responses to therapy. So for an IDH2 mutation, which is a little bit more common than IDH1, I would use a venetoclax-based regimen there. And I'm going to show you the data, I believe I am, from a study looking at enasidenib aza, and then we'll look at talk about the data of venetoclax with azacitidine.
All right. So with respect to FLT3, we'll get into that data as well. What are you recommending in the upfront setting? You have midostaurin out there and quizartinib.
So, you know, the one-liner here, if it's a patient who is fit for intensive chemotherapy, I am giving them 7 and 3 with quizartinib if they have a FLT3 ITD mutation. And, you know, I'll show you some of the data from the Quantum First study that supports that. If they have a FLT3 TKD mutation, I would use midostaurin there. And, in fact, in the subset analysis of the RATIFY trial, that's where they really saw the benefit of the midostaurin.
Thanks for clarifying the differentiation. Last question, you know, we had an FDA approval of revumenib in the patients with the lysine methyl transferase 2. What are your thoughts about where that's going to get incorporated into the practice of AML?
So these drugs are coming. The menin inhibitors clearly have activity in AML with very specific mutations, NPM1 mutation, KMT2A rearrangements, which are seen in both AML and ALL, those mutations. Revumenib is the first in that specific subset. Ziftomenib is coming along probably for NPM1 mutated disease, and there's at least 2 or 3 other drugs that are rapidly coming behind those. And they have single agent activity. So it's going to be very exciting. I'll say a few words about that because we don't have any slides on that. I think the challenge is going to be dealing with the differentiation syndrome, because that's how these drugs work when you're using it as a single agent, distinguishing proliferation from differentiation syndrome, because not all patients respond. The response rates are 30 to 40% with single agents. And then importantly, I know what happens once you get a drug that's approved and you got a backbone that you're used to working with, you're going to try to mix these drugs together. And I would say, please wait for the data that's coming out of the clinical trials of 7 and 3 with these drugs and ASA-VEN with these drugs. I think we have a lot to learn about how to sequence these drugs, how to combine these drugs, and the effects of these drugs on normal myelopoiesis. I mean, menin is there for a reason in our hematopoietic cells. And there is some preclinical data suggesting that if you inhibit menin when a bone marrow is trying to recover from some insult, you are going to decrease count recovery. And I've seen that in some of my patients. So I think we have a lot to learn still about how to use those drugs. So here's what changed everything. Courtney DiNardo and colleagues published this, and in November 2018, the FDA approved ASA-VEN. So you all know the study, 2-to-1 randomization in unfit patients. And you could see a couple of things. Not only was the median survival improved from 10 months with azacitidine, and that's what we have seen in other studies of azacitidine in AML, but it improved up to 15 months with ASA-VEN. But there are 2 points here in this long-term follow-up. Number one, the curves are overlapping at the beginning. And often when you add another drug to myelosuppressive drugs in leukemia patients, you're going to see more toxicity. And that wasn't seen here in terms of mortality, I should say. The mortality was the same. And the reason why I think that's important is I would ask people to avoid the practice of starting an HMA and then waiting for your prior authorization of the venetoclax and just adding it in later, because you don't know at what point you need to actually overlap those two drugs. And remember, this study was done in those patients that you're seeing, poor performance status, age over 75, and still there was no decrement in survival early on. And then you're seeing a plateau on the curve. And if you look at those patients, I'll talk more about them in my case, they often have a very specific mutational profile. So that's become the standard. We'll talk about IDH in a minute.
Quick question. Dose.
The dose of an... Okay.
Next, gonna hold
next
you
question.
Down
okay. The dose is the dose, okay? And this is an important point. Okay, the daily dose is the daily dose, okay? And you change it. It's 400 a day. You ramp it up. 400 a day, okay? Unless you have strong CYP3A4 inhibitors or moderate CYP3A4 inhibitors or PGP inhibitors, then you have dose reductions of 50 to 75% depending on the drug. That doesn't change. It's the duration. That's the key here. In MDS, which I never answered for you, remember in those MDS trials, the duration of the venetoclax was only 14 days. Now in the VIALE-A, it was 28 days. That's too long. You're just getting more myelosuppression. What my practice is to do a bone marrow around day 21, maybe even a little bit earlier, day 18, 19, 20. If the marrow is hypoplastic at that time and has less than 5% blast, I hold venetoclax. And then I allow the counts to recover. And in the next cycle, if I've achieved marrow aplasia or clearance of the blast with 21 days, it makes no sense to me that I have to give 28 days or 21 days the next time even, and I drop it down immediately to 14 days. Okay, so now a lot of you out there are going to push me even more and say, okay, you're down to 14 days. What about this 7 and 7 that everybody's talking about? That makes me a little anxious, okay, because if you only give 7, I don't know if you get added benefit of a little bit more of that venetoclax. And so we have no data from those 7 and 7 studies of what the marrow looks like after 7 days. And so let's say you just do 7 days and then the counts aren't recovering. How long do you wait? When do you do another bone marrow? When you do another bone marrow, do you give 7 days of ven again? Or do you say, oops, I've made it wrong. I better give the full course. So the practical details of doing 7 and 7, I think, worry me. So I do in the first cycle, I aim for 28 days, but I stop it early if they have a clear marrow. And then for subsequent cycles, I will give shorter courses. And because these are older patients who want to enjoy their golden years, I space out the cycles to every 6 weeks.
Those are super helpful tips. Let's look at the quizartinib data now.
So this is, you might say this is a Me Too study, right? We're all used to using midostaurin in our young patients with, or any of our patients with FLT3 mutation or fit for chemotherapy, based on the results of the RATIFY trial. This study started before midostaurin was approved. So the control arm has placebo in it. And it was an international study. It is what it is. There's the control arm is placebo. And that's because of when the study was done. It allows me to make the point of look at how many years we had to wait to get another drug added to our armamentarium based on survival data. But to get to this trial, it was 7 and 3 with either quizartinib for 2 weeks or placebo. Consolidation, the same thing. With 2 weeks of quizartinib or placebo and up to 144 weeks of quizartinib or placebo maintenance, you could actually go on to a transplant. You could get quizartinib after the transplant. Important differences between this study and the midostaurin trial and the RATIFY trial is that our study took patients up to the age of 75. And in fact, 40% of patients were over the age of 60, whereas it was all patients less than 60 in the RATIFY trial. And our study only looked at FLT3 ITD because that's the only place where quizartinib is thought to have activity, although that's changing, maybe. But with midostaurin, it was FLT3 ITD and TKD. And those patient populations have different prognoses. And so with that in mind, if you then look at the outcome, you get a hazard ratio for improvement in survival with quizartinib of 0.78, a 22% reduction in the risk of death. And if you go back to the New England Journal article published by my colleague Rich Stone, it's exactly 0.78. So now you're stuck doing what the prior speaker told us that we can't do, but we do every single day in our clinical practice because we don't have all the data we need. We compare between trials. And so if you actually take the quantum first aid and say, okay, I'm only going to look at the younger patients who are fit for chemotherapy with an ITD on the quantum first study, and those younger patients with a FLT3 ITD only on the RATIFY trial, there's a clear benefit, cross-trial comparison, with quizartinib, with a 38% reduction in the risk of death, 32% reduction in the risk of death with quizartinib in that population versus a 20% reduction in the risk of death. But the most compelling reason that I cite for using quizartinib, in my mind, in this patient population, is that you want to get all these patients to transplant, but you're not going to be able to. There are going to be social barriers, there are going to be geographic barriers, comorbidities, and then complications of the therapy. And even in this trial, even in the RATIFY trial, even in the best hands, only about 50% of patients get to transplant. In the RATIFY trial, there was no survival benefit of getting into a remission with midostaurin versus placebo if you didn't get a transplant. The benefit was only in patients who got midostaurin, got in a remission, and then got the transplant. In this study, we saw a benefit, in fact, a 40% reduction in the risk of mortality if patients got quizartinib versus placebo and didn't get a transplant. In fact, the difference between the curves was even greater than in the group of patients who did get a transplant, where the transplant actually added to the improvement in survival. So for me, that's why, you know, I've used quizartinib in this population. You have to deal with the fact that you are adding a myelosuppressive drug to the backbone of 7 and 3, and there was increased mortality. Now, being the principal investigator on this, I'm privy to maybe to some data that you guys don't have, but you can look at it. You can go to the FDA report on this study. And what you'll notice is that in one region of the world, because it's an international trial, there were more patients randomly assigned to quizartinib than to placebo who were older. And when they got an infection, the FDA pointed out that they didn't get standard of care treatment in terms of first prophylaxis, but treatment. And so I think we still need to use, I'm actually encouraging Daiichi to use the stratification we had in the study to look at outcomes across the world, because the supportive care we have in the United States and Europe may be different than other parts of the world. QT prolongation is like anything else. There's a REMS, 10 slides, 10 questions. You only have to do it once. And it basically wants you to know that you know how to manage QT prolongation. And why are they focusing on this? It wasn't very high rate. They're focusing on it mostly because this is the first time the FDA has approved a drug that inhibits the slow rectifier channel of in cardiac muscle, which is the reason why I'm not going to do internal medicine boards either. I'm not going to do onc or internal medicine. I'm going to stick to heme.
Stay in your lane.
Okay. So what do I do in older patients? You know, azagiltin show a survival benefit. Azaven did not show a survival benefit in the subset analysis. And so people are jumping on the bandwagon of triplets. This is a very effective triplet. Aza, venetoclax, gilteritinib. Keep in mind, at day 14, you do a bone marrow. And if the marrow is clear, you stop both ven and the gilt. And when the counts recover, you go ahead with ven only 7 days, and you keep the patients on a lower dose of gilt, 80 milligrams a day. So there are nuances to the dosing here that you have to know. But the response rate was 100%, a lot of really deep remissions, and you can see the survival here looks very encouraging, and actually better than, again, cross-trial comparisons, better than what we showed in Quantum First. So some people, are using this as a bridge to getting patients to transplant. In my older patients who are not, I'm worried about myelosuppression, I'm still not doing this triplet. I'll start with azaven and use gilteritinib in the second-line setting. I think we haven't talked about this, so maybe I'll just skip it for now. It's in your handout. Gilteritinib was approved based on the results of the ADMIRAL trial in patients with FLT3 ITD or TKD mutated disease that's relapsed refractory after standard chemotherapy. And what you can see here is patients were randomized 2-to-1 to gilteritinib versus chemotherapy, both less intensive and intensive chemo regimens like Ida-Flag and MEC. There was an improvement in median survival from about 6 months up to about 9 months. There was an improvement in 1-year survival. This is the long-term follow-up. And all of those 26 censored marks past 2 years, in all of those 26 gilteritinib-treated patients, 18 underwent transplant. And of those 18 who underwent transplant, 16 received gilteritinib. So the point here is, yes, you can use gilteritinib to get these patients into a remission. It extends survival, but long-term survival is going to depend on getting your patient to a transplant. And if they're still MRD positive, I would consider gilteritinib afterwards based on the Morpho trial data, which you have in your handout. I know we're running late.
Yeah, I think in the interest of time and trying to stay on track for the day, but your insights were incredibly valuable today. I super appreciate it.
Can I say one word about ivosidenib?
Absolutely.
Okay, because that was the question that came up. I'm going to skip enasidenib. The only thing I'm going to say here is not only was the survival, median survival improved beyond azacitidine, and again, cross-trial comparisons, it was 15 months for the IDH1 mutated patients getting azaven and Viale-A, and here you could see it was 29 months with Ivo-Aza. Okay, that could be due to whatever drug the patient gets afterwards, after they relapse. Okay, but the reason why I support using ivosidenib in the first line here is that it's easier for patients, because once they respond, there's no playing with the dose. You don't have to ask me what's the dose. It's 2 tablets a day for 28 days. It's not myelosuppressive. 15% had differentiation syndrome. It was managed in all those patients. There was no death due to it. And finally, in the patient that was presented, I wouldn't be surprised if that patient's white blood cell count actually got better during that first cycle, which is shown in the AGILE trial, and actually correlated with a lower risk of febrile neutropenia. Thanks for letting me see
that. Yeah, thank you guys. Yeah, absolutely. That was great. Thank you again so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks.